Welcome to the Minivate Gang Podcast, episode 294. I'm Steve Borsch, and I'm on with Tim Elliott.
What are we at? In some sort of a lounge somewhere?
And Phil Wilson.
Cigars, cigarettes, balloons.
And Graham is on his way to CES, or he's packing to go to CES.
Packing for CES. And you know, know how that is for Graham, because he has so many outfits he has to find room for.
Precisely.
And his many shoes.
Yes, yes.
So I can't make it because I'm packing.
What? Yeah. And then Delta keeps saying, sir, we don't really take trunks.
nice steamer trunk, dude.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Well, let's see. Kind of a slower day in the world, or week in the world of tech, wouldn't you say?
It is. Well, yeah. Yeah, there's not a lot going on. I'm sure there's a lot of CES stuff that'll come out, announcements, and, you know, there's some Minnesota companies out there. But what is this one about launching? Minnesota launches new website tracking government spending. Did we talk about this at some point?
I don't know if we did or not. Because it's, you know, transparency. Is it transparency.mn or something like that?
No, it's mn.gov and then mn.gov, some URL. That's it. Yeah. Well, I think this is a good thing. I mean,
I think it's a good thing.
Been a lot of attempts to do this at the federal level.
Serves to piss you off when you think about college tuition. But other than that,
yeah. Well, I like the fact that they talk about on this website making Minnesota's state government finances and operations more transparent and accountable to citizens. Well, the problem is like any budget, you know, they'll show you just the high level, and I want to drill down into all the data and really see, you know, so what are certain expenditures, you know, because that's like when they do these bond referendums for school districts, you know, it's like, yes, we need $6 million. Well, what for technology? Oh, okay. Yeah. We'll vote for that.
Yeah. You know, technology.
Yeah. Technology. I mean, what kind of technology, and, you know, what's it going to be used for, and so on. But I suppose that's why we have elected representatives, right?
I suppose.
Yeah.
I suppose.
Well, we could go in here and see all the contracts. That's got to be entertaining.
Well, I think and it's important to do, you know, especially to look at salary information, especially if you're looking for a job.
I was just looking for the salary listings. I haven't found it yet. Got to figure that out.
This is pretty good, though.
It is.
I mean, I'm looking at the. It says at the top, MN Open Checkbook.
Huh. Yeah, I'm looking at that too.
Crazy.
Yeah, it's a spreadsheet with.
Yeah.
Where is that?
All the numbers.
Well, if you drill into this, I'm in the state contracts deal, so you can see all the contracts, who's getting what. So it's interesting.
Yeah. You have to spend a little more time with it.
It's definitely something that will take some time to digest.
Well, and I just drilled into the Minnesota State Crime Bureau's budget.
Are you on a list there?
Yeah, there's a line item here that says Phil Wilson, Lakeville, Minnesota, sting operation.
A sting.
$100,000. Gee, I wonder what that is.
Just walk right into that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't. Sting operations are. Yeah, it's probably pretty easy for me. I just okay, whatever you say.
Yeah.
But anyway,
well, so Julio, our buddy Julio over at the Pioneer Press has been. He's actually been pinging people, asking them if they have huge phones, if they've gone with phablets, and.
He didn't ping me, and I have a big phone.
Oh, he didn't. Well, he did on Facebook and Twitter and stuff.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, and so a good article about that. And what do you, Tim, do you love your big phone? I mean, do you think that this is where it's going to go, that we're all going to be walking around with phablets?
Nope. No, I think that smaller phones will sort of make a comeback, and that people, it really depends on how you use technology. And so I like the phablet because I was using a 7-inch tablet to mainly to read magazines, maybe some books, although I do have a Kindle too, which I can read books on. And now I do that all on the phone, and I sold my tablet. Mm. So it replaces the tablet. Now, for a lot of people that won't work, and some people just, you know, this don't like big phones. So I think you're going to see, in fact, I almost put in my prediction for last week that Apple will have, you know, like a iPhone 6 mini, which would be like the 5 or the 4-inch phone back, but have all the internals of the iPhone 6, which I think a lot of people would love.
Oh, yeah. They would love that. Yeah, that'd be great.
Why wouldn't they do it? Like, maybe they call it the iPhone 6 Nano.
There we go. That would be new.
Jeez.
Well, so yeah. I think it depends on how you use it, and not everyone will like it, but I enjoy it. I think it's good.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of funny how the new normal becomes 5.7 inches.
Well, it does. Well, I went out and I ordered a new iMac Retina, and it should be here next week. And I was upset with my case because the case that I had was this pretty rugged case for my iPhone, and I bought the Apple leather case, and I think you have that, Phil.
No, I don't.
Six, or you've got the...
No, I've got a spec case on my 6 now.
Oh, do you? So, okay.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
After my incident with the floor, yes.
Yeah. Oh. I love the thing, and it actually feels... almost like you're just holding the phone itself because it's so sleek, and it's changed how I like it.
Can I step back a second? Did you say you were getting the Retina, the iMac Retina? Is that what you said?
Yes. Yeah.
You're getting the iMac Retina.
I am.
Did you fully get it fully spec'd out, or did you just get the base model?
Well, I got 32 gigs of RAM, the 4 gigahertz i7. Oh, a terabyte my. SSD.
So how much over 3,000 was it?
We don't want to go there. I don't want to say I don't want to say publicly. But you know what?
Well, we can figure it out. Hang on.
Yeah, we can spec it out right now.
We can go ahead and spec it out right now. Apple.com.
Okay.
You just talk.
Steve's into Apple for another 5K.
Well, yeah, I did get the friends and family discount through somebody at the Apple store at Mall of America, but... So that saved 15%, but it was like $4,600 when everything was all said and done. But you know what? I make my living with this device.
Yes.
And so it's tough. But here's the funny part, and I'll even put this in the show notes. But back in 2009, I wrote a post and put a screenshot of the Mac 2CI that I'd purchased through an Apple employee named Jim Hogan, a guy I've known for years. And the invoice, this was at 60, the Apple employees could buy a bundle at 60% of retail price. And he let me use his discount. It's called First Discount. And so my cost for a Mac 2CI, a 13-inch color monitor, and cables and stuff was $4,193.
Oh, my.
And so when I look at the price of this iMac 27-inch Retina and what it does for $4,600 or whatever I spent on it, you look at the present value of money, and if you just use the Consumer Price Index from the time I bought this machine in August of 1990, until today, it's $7,600 is what I'd be spending in today's dollars on this Mac 2CI. So, you know, you look at this iMac, it's a pretty damn good value.
Yeah, but I wonder how much it would have been in 2009 dollars.
Well, I could probably figure that out.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no. There's a calculator.
It's not really worth
online.
That much time spending. That, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so anyway,
it's a great value.
I moved away from phablets. Sorry, guys. Did anybody else have anything more to say about phablets? I got a kick out of the woman that was in the article that Julio did on the phablets, and the fact that she, her husband, accidentally ordered the 6 Plus,
Oh, yeah.
She wanted the six, but she asked, why would you send it back if it's not what you wanted? I couldn't quite figure that one out.
Well, and you have 14 days.
Yeah.
So you can definitely do that. So,
alrighty.
Yeah, I'll do that with my iMac. I'm going to give it 14 days. If I don't like it, I'll just send it back. So,
yeah, I'm sure you'll hate it.
you know what's funny about it?
It's going to be so clunky. Oh, yeah. You're just showing off now. You're just making us all jealous. No.
So, I got a buddy that bought one, mm-hmm. And he's a graphic designer. And he said, I got it. And the first night I got it, I spent 2.5 hours going through my photos, and it's like I'd never seen them before. It was so much clearer and nicer.
Anyway. Nice. So you're looking forward to it.
Yeah. I'm going to go sit and go through my photos. You guys want to come over?
No.
That's okay. I looked at it at the Apple store.
We'll wait for the slideshow.
Yeah, right.
And you can tell it's better, but it's not as dramatic as I expected it to be.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
because they have them side by side with regular ones, and the regular screens are pretty darn good.
Darn,
they
nice.
Really are.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Well, I've got a Thunderbolt monitor that I just is like night and day for me against, you know, the old ViewSonics that I still have two ViewSonic 21 inch or 22 inch machine or monitors here at home, but I would imagine the difference between just the Thunderbolt and this is just amazing. So.
Yeah.
Anyhow,
so other stories, this will be a big one.
Everybody hop into Steve's favorite wheelhouse these days, the Internet of Things.
Well, so there's an article, I'll put this in the link in the show notes, about the Internet of Things products to grab the spotlight at CES 2015. And in fact, Alex Hawkinson, the CEO, well, I don't know if they consider him CEO of SmartThings anymore, but after they got acquired by Samsung, but he's going to be giving the keynote address at CES, and they're going to live stream it on Monday at I think 8:30 our time. So if anybody wants to watch that, but yeah, the Internet of Things is going to be a big deal. Yeah, you know, the only thing is everybody keeps talking about home automation, and they'll throw in things like refrigerators and clothes washers and other household appliances. And it's like, I'm sorry. Do you guys want an LCD monitor in your washer and dryer? Or do you need sensors on them?
No.
Sure. Why not?
But I don't need TV screens at the gas pump either.
But I get them.
I get them anyway.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Have you guys seen anything related to any service companies yet that are offering that they'll monitor your sensors?
Well, you know, I did find out that just yesterday, as I was kind of going through the manual for a new refrigerator, as we finished our remodel of our kitchen, and we've got a Samsung fridge, realized that it was internet connected, so I can actually monitor it if I had an app on my Android phone.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They don't have an iPhone version?
No, they don't have an iPhone version for it.
Well, wow, that's crazy.
Uh-huh.
Interesting.
So, so yeah, I guess I have a connected device now. Now my wife is going, it's like, why would we need to monitor the refrigerator? It's like,
I do that a lot.
Don't really know.
Well, honey,
I can turn the ice maker on and off. Don't know why I'd do that, but he could. And you can monitor the power usage and all that.
Well, that's useful.
Well, I suppose, but
are
you going to spend a lot of time adjusting the power usage on your refrigerator? If it's always spiking a little bit, I'll save a cent and a half and roll it back.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe not.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, the Internet of Things is very exciting, but yeah, again, why do you need to monitor your refrigerator? You know, what's it do? Why do you need to monitor? I mean, I could see monitoring an oven if you wanted to preheat or something like that, but I'm not exactly sure, you know, a fridge, is it necessary?
Yeah. Well, The Verge had a great article on other things that were going on at CES and things that we should expect. One was more about self-driving cars,
right?
Which I thought was interesting.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think the self-driving car thing is probably less about, you know, a completely autonomous vehicle as opposed to the things that kind of come out of the research and the technology that goes into making an autonomous, the sensors, the cameras, the, you know, that sort of a thing. So, I mean, you see the auto backup or the auto, you know, park features that have become sort of prolific in, you know, mid to high end cars. And,
yeah,
you know, I look at what's on a lot of cars now with their rear cameras and the warnings that you can set up for braking and that sort of thing. So I think that's, it's like the autonomous car is now sort of R&D for pieces that are going to find their way into the showrooms.
Yeah. Well, Tim, what do you think about, is it, I don't know how to pronounce it. Huawei? H-U-A-W-E-I?
Huawei.
Huawei. Huawei. Thank you. And that their shipments topped 75 million units in 2014. A lot of people are expecting a lot out of them and the other Chinese manufacturers like Acer and Lenovo, even though we don't know really what they're going to do at CES. But
didn't the Lenovo bought the Motorola business?
Right.
And then I also noticed that, what is it, Alcatel? They bought Palm. So we could see a resurgence of the Palm brand again without WebOS.
Right.
I wonder what operating system they'd use. I guess they'd use Android.
Android, probably.
Huh. So anyway, I think that's kind of interesting. But you're going to see more and more low-end but very good quality, good enough quality phones flood the market from China.
I think so too, yeah.
No, I was I was at the Microsoft store the other day, and they have a display of all of these blue phones, BLU.
Yes, so right? Is Micro Center, yeah.
And I was shocked at how good of quality they were for, like, super-duper cheap. Some of them were under $100.
Well, there's one that Micro Center has that I don't remember the model number that's a blue phone, and I was looking at it side by side with the latest Samsung Galaxy phone, and this blue phone was $299, and it was unlocked, and it was phenomenal. So
yeah, so that's another one. I guess they're a Chinese brand again,
right?
So I'm not that familiar with them.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they are. Huh.
So
yeah. Well, I'll put a link in the show notes to an array of phones for blue. And so people can go take a look at that. But yeah, it's a surprisingly good product for not a lot of dough.
Are you going to go ahead and get that then? Are you going to trade in the iPhone?
Probably not.
I didn't think so.
So, Steve, what's this story in the Strib about the Internet of Things as a soft target for hackers?
Well, that's everybody's favorite.
And then they have a big picture of the Honeywell Lyric thermometer, right. The thermostat, whatever. Yeah.
Well, that's the local tie-in. Well, really, everybody's buzzing about security being the number one issue going forward for the Internet of Things, because there are so many different platforms, there are so many different devices coming in from so many different vendors that to be able to cordon things off and be able to ensure that none of those things can be attack vectors into a network is, stopping a lot of people in their tracks relative to adoption. And so, it's a bigger deal in the supply chain when, you've got sensors in warehouses and you've got all kinds of hubs everywhere. In the supply chain, there's all these ways that hackers can get in. And so as a consequence, there's a lot of concern. And this is really top of the agenda for just about every conference I've seen relative to the Internet of Things. So that's all I have to say on it.
That's all I got.
Do they have a Norton antivirus for your Internet of Things yet?
No. Nope.
Hmm.
No.
There's a million-dollar opportunity there.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no. This stuff will all be built into the hubs and into the platforms. And so, you know, it's just how it's going to have to be. So Google, who put the story in here about Google posts a Windows 8.1 vulnerability before Microsoft can patch it?
I did. I thought it was kind of a funny story.
It was. Why don't you tell about it?
Project Zero from Google, which I've never heard of before. They track vulnerabilities, and they're trying to shame Microsoft to fix a bug that they warned them about, I guess, privately. I don't know how long did they take it. They reported on September 30th, so they gave them a good 90 days to fix it.
Yeah.
And they haven't fixed it yet. So Google put it on the internet, on the site, saying, hey, here is a vulnerability. We reported it, and it's still a problem.
Well, you know, Microsoft's busy.
Yeah, they're busy.
They're really busy.
Yeah.
Got lots going on, and you know, vacation time. They'll get to it.
It's the holidays.
Yeah. It's
it's the holidays. Yeah, couldn't Google wait until, you know, I don't know, the middle of next month?
Yeah.
Or at least at least Tuesday. Maybe they're gonna dispatch Tuesday. They're gonna fix it.
Well, and you know,
you don't know.
But there's so many vulnerabilities that are also known about that haven't been patched for years. You know, like all the stuff with OpenSSL, which, you know, a lot of certificate vendors rely on and web hosts and everything else. And there's still vulnerabilities in OpenSSL. You know, they're not showstoppers, but there's a lot of stuff out there in the kernels and things like that. Usually you need direct access to devices, though. You need to have them in your hands or have access to them directly rather than over the network. So they're not maybe as severe, but I frankly like this Project Zero. The only kicker, the only possible kicker is I had a certificate on a low-level site, an SSL certificate, and Google has shifted now that any certificate using SHA-1, which is insecure, they're now putting a line through the padlock showing that, you know, and then you pop it up and it says it's not secure and here's why. And so they're basically shaming us all into upgrading our, you know, reissuing our certificates under SHA-2, and which is a good thing, right? Don't you think?
I guess I'm undecided if I think that, you know, Google sort of demanding that you buy an SSL certificate is a good or bad idea. You know, they're starting to, you know, influence their search results based on that.
Very slightly. Yeah.
Right. But I think over time, you know, it'll become more and more important. And, you know, if you're running a blog or whatever, like Minovate, for example, there's no reason that we need SSL on Minovate.
No.
But I don't know. We've got some pretty high tech stuff we talk about.
Well, if we sold t-shirts, maybe we would want it, but
yeah,
you know, until then, I there's not a good reason for it.
Wait a minute. That's a great idea. Let's sell t-shirts.
Oh, boy.
Sell t-shirts.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, man. Why not?
Oh, my God.
Brother.
Don't we have those? We have those Minovate temporary tattoos we give out at the fair at our booth, right? Oh, wait a minute. That's not us.
That's right. You know, we could actually go to Cafe Press.
Yes, we could.
Sign up for a... an account, and people could then buy.
We could, but
t-shirts,
we won't.
And, yeah,
because you know, Cafe Press is ultra expensive, so you don't really.
You know, they really are, aren't they?
Yeah,
well, it's because they do such low volumes. But I actually one of the companies that I was a tech advisor to out in the Bay Area, faculty who's no longer around, unfortunately, they were going to a couple different shows, and they had, you know, these really nice button down cotton shirts made with their logo, and they had baseball caps, and then they had t-shirts and I think bags or something all made, and they, you know, they just could make 10 of each, know, slap their logo on it. Yeah, it was expensive, but it was less expensive than, you know, having to buy, you know, 100 of them through a traditional vendor. So yeah, it's kind of cool. Crickets.
It's kind of cool. It's kind of cool.
Anyone use the Twitter app?
No, don't.
No,
I don't. But apparently they've added this while you were away algorithm. Yeah. They give you sort of a
timeline, sort of.
What they do is they give you a best of, I guess, a best of when you were gone.
In their view.
Yeah, it's probably based on clicks and reshares and, you know, all sorts of stuff. It's a fairly interesting idea, but it still doesn't, you know, make me want to switch off of Hootsuite.
No, exactly. Right. And I was thinking the same thing. It's like, yeah, but I've got Hootsuite. Why would I mean, how many people actually use the Twitter stock stuff?
I think normal people, most of them use that, but
really
tech savvy folks and folks like us that have multiple accounts and we're doing client work, we're all going to use something that makes that part of it easier. And for me, it's Hootsuite. So,
right.
Yeah. Well, I use Tweetbot cause I only have three accounts that I need to care about and manage, but,
that's right. Now that I've got an iPhone, I could actually use Tweetbot. Couldn't I?
I love Tweetbot.
You could.
That's
what all the cool kids use.
Yeah,
I suppose. And yeah. That's a paid app, right?
Yeah,
it is. But you can get it for like a buck or two. You know, if you watch the sales, I think it's $4.99. I want to say something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So even if you pay full freight, it's not that expensive.
Okay. Says you.
I kind of like for iOS, I kind of still like, what is that? Twitterific. You know, it's like one of the first Twitter apps.
Right.
Yeah.
I like that unified timeline thing. So.
Yeah. Well, the only thing that's good about that Hootsuite is you can do stuff like scheduling, which you can't do with Tweetbot. And, you know, Tweetbot's really real-time stuff. But what I found what is really fascinating is how many people I know, including my daughter and some of my other family members, is they're using Instagram for all their photo tweeting because they can do both Facebook and Twitter at the same time. And that seems to be a lot more prevalent, surprisingly, than other methods. Have you guys ever done that?
Mm.
Yeah, it works really well.
Huh.
So, well, this was, Tim, I know this is an issue with, potentially with Comcast, but, big story, Google strikes an upbeat note with FCC on Title II. And basically what they're trying to do is to treat, broadband internet providers like Google Fiber as telecommunication services under Title II.
Yep.
And so that would then expose Google Fiber, but everybody else to the same regulations, but it would open up the rights of way on telephone poles and through pipes that the cable companies have enjoyed for forever since the 80s.
I didn't know that Google did not have these right of ways.
Yeah, so, they have to get them separately. Yep.
Yeah, so I could see that's a barrier for competition, which is not good for consumers, you know.
Right.
And it's not good for Google to roll out Google Fiber. So, you know, my personal opinion is that Title II is bad for consumers ultimately, because the FCC will do what they've wanted to do a long time with cable TV in particular, which is regulate it, to like they regulate broadcast television.
Yeah.
And the only reason you have the freedom you have on HBO and other cable networks is because the FCC does not regulate them. So as soon as they do that, you're going to see things like, we'll probably have to get a license to do a podcast. So there will be speech issues that will be, you know, that'll come out of this. But on the flip side, I think that Google should have the right of way to, you know, to be able to compete head to head with anybody and have the same access to utility poles and whatever conduits and all this kind of stuff. So I kind of was surprised. So I can see that if it does go down the Title II route, which it seems to be headed, that will be one of the good things that comes out of it. But I think that ultimately it will be bad for the internet. It will be bad for consumers. We'll be paying a lot more. And I don't know. I haven't talked to anybody who thinks that they pay too little for internet in this country.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Because if you talk to anyone who lives, you know, in any other country in Europe, they pay significantly less for better service than we do. Mm-hmm. And now part of that's because they live in countries where there's, you know, concentration of population, and the government has paid for all of the fiber to be laid and all that kind of stuff. So the infrastructure was government sponsored. And they don't have to deal with great distances. So, but at the same time, you know, in France and in the UK, there are, you know, 15 or 20 providers of internet access, and that are all competing for the consumer. So,
right.
And, you know, here it seems like we're getting fewer and fewer providers of such services.
Well, and you know, what was interesting was, so I have 75 megabits per second down and 20 up for my Comcast business connection.
And hey, Tim, have you ever noticed that Steve always kind of flaunts his size?
Yeah.
You know, he's always kind of saying, you know, I got this better iMac.
I've got this really
big internet speed. It's like, I'm just waiting.
I bet he has a 128 gig iPhone as well.
Does he?
I do.
He's coming after you, Wilson. He says, Phil, that 64 gig is not big enough.
I'm telling you, you guys.
I don't know. It's like, it's all about size for this guy. Is he compensating, do you think?
Well, that's why I went out and bought a Corvette. No, I didn't.
He's got a Prius.
Yeah. Prius and a Corvette.
Corvette.
Yeah. Well, you know, gas is under $2 a gallon now. I think I'll go buy a GMC Yukon.
Yeah, exactly. So. Get me started.
Okay, so the reason I brought up the thing about the 75 down, 20 up is because I had a buddy that had Verizon Fios, and he lives in northern New Jersey, and he had 75 down, 75 up, symmetrical, and he was paying $39.95 a month. Well, guess what? They've slowly but surely, this is Verizon Fios, they've slowly but surely gone up in price. And they've also put together bundles, and you can only buy it through bundles now. So you have to take internet and TV. You can't just take internet unless you're a business class customer, and then you also pay more. But so he did the whole triple play thing, right, with internet, phone, and TV. And he's paying like $150 a month for that, which is a pretty good deal. You know, you got 75 down, 75 up, but you know, the speeds used to be off the charts for not a lot of money, but that's really shifted. And I wonder if the same thing will hold true when fiber becomes more ubiquitous, if you know, Comcast will continue to push the speeds up, because they could right now do 160 down, and they could make it symmetrical if they wanted to.
So I think you'll have to get some new equipment, though. So there's two things. One is that they'll have to support the new DOCSIS 3.1, I think it is, spec. And even though I work with Comcast, I have no idea if they're even working on that. I suspect they probably are. But, you know, who knows when they're going to deploy it. And, you know, the local Comcast is likely to become its own entity later this year after the Time Warner merger happens. So,
yep.
So who knows what's going to happen then? But it's theoretically possible you can get a lot more bandwidth. In fact, with 3.1, you can compete head to head with fiber. It's just your uplink is not symmetrical. Yeah. And it probably won't be just for technical reasons, I would think, or network loading reasons, but it'll still be very, very fast.
Yeah.
I we were last week, we were visiting our in-laws, and they have AT&T DSL, and it's in a kind of a remote community outside of Hot Springs. And the speed there was like two megabits. And I'm like, this is just horrendously bad. But everything still worked. And, you know, we still did Skype, you know, last week for the podcast. Yeah. And it seemed okay. You know,
it sounds great. Yeah, you sounded fine.
So it you know, even very, very slow internet in kind of rural areas, it still does work okay. And you don't really need that bandwidth. It's just if you're going to do streaming of Netflix and other things like that, then yeah, you need more bandwidth to be able to do those things.
So over the holidays, we were streaming a movie that started to buffer, and realized that we were streaming Netflix. My daughter was streaming off Hulu Plus, and my son was upstairs also streaming through Netflix, and even my 75 megabit per second couldn't handle it. Now, part of that might be Netflix itself. If you got two accounts in the same house, trying to keep the packets going to the right place, maybe I don't know, but you know, even that was hiccuping a little bit, which is kind of interesting. But so this was a big deal. I thought this article about Microsoft building a new web browser as part of its Windows 10 push.
That's why they couldn't fix that vulnerability. They were busy with that.
They were busy building Spartan.
Yeah, that's right. That's Spartan. Right. But now, of course, Spartacus. They're doing their own thing, though.
Yeah,
you know? I know. So rather than leverage anything else, so now you got Firefox with Gecko, and you've got WebKit for Chrome and Safari, and now you're going to have Microsoft doing their own thing again. Once again, there's going to be all these issues relative to web development and deployment that, you know, you'll have to support yet another browser. It's like, my God, come on.
Yeah. Well, Internet Explorer is not terribly chunky, I think, you know, in the scheme of things. I think that Firefox is not as light as it could be. Chrome is getting more and more heavy, but it's still fairly light. And, you know, Safari is probably the lightest of all of them.
Yeah.
As far as, you know.
Well, and it does the least.
Resources and speed and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
True.
Well, I wonder if they're going to do, because I have not yet read this, but one of the benefits to the way that Chrome handles each tab is each tab is a separate process, which, of course, then spawns the Google Helper daemon, which runs in the background. So if you open up, like on OS X, if you open up Activity Monitor and you have 20 tabs open, you see 20 iterations of Google Helper running in the background.
Yeah, at least.
Yeah. And so, the good news is that everything is siloed. So, you know, if something crashes in one of the browser tabs, it's not going to take your browser down. But if you're like any of us, really, I think more and more people are, you know, they've got a workspace of a whole bunch of tabs that they have open because they're using them all the time. And I wonder if Microsoft's effort is going to also move in that same direction. What do you think?
Maybe.
But you haven't heard anything.
No. Okay. No, I thought this story was interesting just because we might get a decent browser for Microsoft.
They
could mess it up, I guess, but
question is, will it be WebKit compatible? That's the important thing.
Probably not. Yeah, because who did they buy way back in the day when they put Internet Explorer into Windows? This is like Windows 95 era. They bought a company, and they started with that technology.
Oh man!
Remember, it was, I forgot what it was.
Was it like a paper company? What was it?
No, it was another. It was, you know how back in those days. I mean, Netscape was still around, so they had that
Spyglass Mosaic.
Okay.
So the original Mosaic came from NCSA, the National Computing. What is it? NCSA is National Center for Supercomputing Applications. But
right, and that's the one that Andreessen did when he was in college.
Right, and then Spyglass was a commercial licensing partner. I remember those guys were in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's right. And then they basically, the license to Microsoft provided Spyglass and thus NCSA with a quarterly fee plus a percentage of Microsoft's revenues for the software. And I'm sure Microsoft is probably still paying royalties on that. Maybe that's part of the method of their madness.
Yeah, I don't know. But Microsoft has always been sort of, company that does things very quickly through acquisition. So they'll acquire something that they need like that, or they'll pay a licensing fee to build it in. Because remember, they were way, way far behind of everybody inside Windows. And then all of a sudden, they were at least on par.
Right.
And I'm not saying that the Mac was great on the internet, early on, but at least you could, it was easier to hook up a Mac to the internet than it was a Windows machine.
Well, and also then we were using, rather than Netscape, using Internet Explorer for the Mac. Remember that?
I never used Internet Explorer. I used Netscape and then...
Oh, Netscape. I remember that.
Yeah, because that's what I was at Kodak, and that's what we got. We got we had Mosaic, and then we got Netscape, and that was what we had right up until I left Kodak in 1998. I want to say was like Netscape Navigator, I think, was the thing. And I guess they were still in business then, but handwriting was on the wall that they were going away.
Right.
And then what did I use after that? Because I was still on the Mac, and I guess I continued to use that until Safari came out. So
yeah,
And then when Chrome came out, I adopted Chrome. I guess for a time I did use Firefox, and I guess a lot of people did for a time, but then it got too heavy. It's still good for web development, I think, and I use it for that. Because there's a lot of good plugins for web development, which most of them are now on Chrome as well. But they seem to be better, more robust on Firefox, and I don't know why, but they are.
Yeah.
But anywho, but for normal people, I would say Chrome is probably the best browser these days.
Well, before we get to some other security stuff, this was a huge article, and it was in Der Spiegel, the German publication, and it's called "Prying Eyes: Inside the NSA's War on Internet Security," and it's a new analysis of some of the trove of Edward Snowden's documents, and really goes through what the NSA finds easy and what they find very, very difficult or sometimes impossible to crack relative to security. It's really worth a good read. It's not very long, I don't think.
No, but this is a story that's really not being covered in depth by the US media.
Yeah, surprisingly.
Surprisingly. Yeah. And I was kind of peaked when I saw the sustained Skype collection.
I know. Yeah.
So if we ever need to go back and get a Skype recording of this show from February 2011 forward, apparently the NSA has it. But well, before that, those old shows from before then.
yeah.
Those they don't have. But yeah, it's very chilling, I think.
Well, do you remember back in, and I'll see if I can find my post of Skype going down. And there was a blame on Microsoft's Windows update that apparently it did something to make Skype hiccup and that ended up taking Skype down worldwide. And I remember doing a post, with my tinfoil hat on about how it was likely that this was a way to essentially reboot Skype and put in a backdoor. So yeah, it was in 2008. And so we know for sure that there's a backdoor in Skype.
Yep.
So
this confirms it.
Maybe we should say all the words: Tor, Al Qaeda. What else should we say?
Sure. See you, brother.
See if there's.
I think there's back doors in Tor as well.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's not even safe. But at the near the end of the article, it talks about pretty good privacy, which is still uncrackable apparently.
Yeah. Well, it's still too hard to use. You know.
Well, but if you're Edward Snowden or you know someone like that, there you can encrypt your email using that technology.
Right. Right. Well, you know that, or perhaps you did not hear, and I'll put a link in the show notes, but Phil Zimmerman, the creator of PGP, and Ladard Levinson, who's the guy that had LavaBit that was, he took offline because it was either that or hand over everything to the government so they could go through everybody's email. At any rate, they're creating something called Darkmail, and it is... set for no, but it's going to be encrypted.
The email, it's endorsed by the Islamic State and Edward Snowden. They make funny bedfellows, don't they?
Well, come on,
dark mail.
Well, now there's
mail address is
yeah. Well, there's been articles now that they say that 80% of Tor usage is for child porn. And, you know, it's almost, that's almost like a default position to paint some technology as evil and because only evildoers are using it. And I will tell you that.
So why would you call it dark mail then?
Because, you know, it's like the black phone. There's this whole meme of the dark net, for example, which is hidden.
Why don't they call it freedom mail?
Yeah.
Like freedom mail. That sounds better.
Yeah, see, that's why you're a marketer, Tim.
it's better than dark mail.
Yeah, dark mail sounds sinister. Sounds like something Dr. Evil would use.
This is exactly. It's the mail that you would use if you use child porn.
that's what I wanted.
Okay. I do use a secure email so I can email clients and I have them sign up for it as well. And the reason what do you use?
What's it called?
It's called, I knew you were going to ask me that and I forgot now.
It's not dark mail, I bet.
No. Cause it's not out yet. Oh my God. It just blew out of my brain. I'll stick a link in the show notes, but the reason I do that is because I have clients routinely email me credentials for their GoDaddy account or that whatever registrar they're using for their domain name, they'll email usernames and passwords. And I keep telling them, don't do that. Go sign up here. Send me a secure email. Then I can log in and get it. Don't be sending that stuff through the mail.
And I use IM for that.
Yeah.
Because most IM clients are encrypted.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, just for that same reason, because it's if you send it to email, it's in the open.
It's in the open. Anybody running a mail relay server can have keyword searches and just grab stuff as it comes through.
Yep.
So if anything that has the word password in it, you just grab it. So, yeah.
How's that horse of yours, Steve?
You mean this one?
Steve's security tip of the week.
Hey, he's still in good shape.
Oh, it's time.
Good to hear him.
It's time. All right, so here's my...
Have you ever told the story as to why there's horses in our...
I don't know. The horse is out of the barn. I just thought it was funny too.
The horse is out of the barn. Got you now, boy. That is encrypted.
It reminds me also of Young Frankenstein.
Oh, it does. Yeah,
that's right. Booker,
All right. Well, all right, so I have 5 security New Year's resolutions that you guys and everyone listening should make.
Okay.
That number one, always use 2-factor authentication wherever possible. And I'll put a link in here to what it is and also all the sites that use 2-factor authentication. But basically what it does is that, you know, you log in with your password, but then you have to have your phone or the 10 codes that you usually can get as well, to put in. And, so that they know it's you, because you're the only one that has your phone, for example. You can run an authenticator app. So I use two-factor for sites like Gmail and Dropbox and, even WordPress.com. LastPass, obviously. So somebody would have to not only steal my master passwords for each one of those, but they'd also have to have my phone. And so two-factor authentication is really important. The second one is, please use a password manager. If I hear one more person say, well, let's just put a...
I just use the same one.
Just put a pound sign at the end of it. It's like, no, that's not going to be.
You mean password 123 is not secure?
I'm afraid not, Tim.
Try PT.
Yeah.
3 pound sign.
But I have 2-factor authentication on, so you know, password 123 is should be fine.
Well, it's,
see,
there's that. Yeah, right. There's a good argument. Well, I've got a link in here for the 15 best iPhone password manager apps, and I'll also put one in here for Android.
But the LastPass is really the only one you need.
LastPass, or if you're a iOS user, 1Password. Is 1Password available for Android?
It is, yes.
Okay. It is, but I still
and use it. And they have a version for Windows as well. I have licenses for all of them.
Oh.
But I still use LastPass. And the reason that I use LastPass is I can give you a password, share it with you, and you don't know what the password is.
Correct.
You know what I mean? So I haven't been into 1Password in a year. So maybe they support it now, but that was sort of a deal breaker for me. So I've been LastPass ever since.
I adore LastPass. I have right now 773 sites and various secure notes and everything else in here. And I used to keep this in a text file in a disk image that was encrypted with 256-bit encryption, and my wife and kids knew the passphrase, but I never kept it current. Right. So I figure if I got hit by a bus or I drop dead or something, that they're screwed. They can't get into anything. They can't do anything. And now my wife in her LastPass has my LastPass login stuff. And so, if something happens to me, all she has to do is just log into my LastPass and see all the bad things I've been doing. Mm. At all these sites. No.
And it's still only $12 a year, too, which is a great deal, where if you do go down the 1Password route, and I have to say that 1Password is a great, very well designed application, very, very easy to use. And if you're all Apple, it's probably the one to use, but you have to license it separately for everything. So if you have an iPhone, you got to license that, and it's what, $35 or whatever it is. And then you got an iPad. Oh, well, it's another $35 for that.
Right.
Got a Mac. Well, there's another $35. So it adds up to quite a lot, very quickly.
And on the iOS side, especially if you have Touch ID, they've gone with a setup where if it's running in the background, you can either put in a PIN number or just put your thumb on your Touch ID and it opens it up. So they've made it much, much more useful. And they've also made the browser better. So that's a bonus. But okay.
All right. So we've done two.
So number three,
2-factor authentication and password manager. Oh, number three is
be smart with your computing.
What does that mean?
I know, isn't it nebulous? Well, anyway,
it is. So
always update your stuff, always back up your systems. And more importantly, on your laptop that you're taking around to a coffee shop and to school or whatever you're doing, is use a short time frame screensaver, set it for 5 minutes or set it for 2 minutes, that requires your master password upon wake. And the reason is if you get up to go to the bathroom and somebody walks over and makes a couple of modifications on your machine, that's it. You're screwed. So at least do that as well. But I put a link in here that MIT, the engineering college, has this top 10 safe computing tips for MIT students. And there's all kinds of other great tips on there as well. So it's a good one-stop shop. Okay, so number four, encrypt your hard drive, especially with your laptop. Because again, if your laptop gets stolen and somebody can just open it up and get in, and they've got to especially have access to your email because it's running in your browser, for example, then all they have to do is go to your other sites and change the password and get it back to your email, and now they can go in and change the passwords everywhere, you know, to your bank and Schwab and whatever. So, you know, having that screensaver password and then also encrypting your hard drive means they're not going to be able to get anything off of it. And BitLocker is now available on Windows. It's built in, and FileVault 2 on OS 10 is also built in. And it's a great way to secure it. I also do a third thing, which is put a firmware password on my laptop. So if somebody steals it, they're not going to be able to even wipe the hard. They're going to have to remove the hard drive and replace it to be able to use it as a computer. And so I have this screen that says at the front, hey, oh, by the way, I've secured this thing with a firmware password, so you can't even reboot it. So please give me a call. There's a reward for the return of this laptop. And so hopefully somebody won't throw it away. They'll try to get a return. And then number five, use a VPN. I know I've said this ad nauseum, but I'll put a link in here from Lifehacker, the five best VPN service providers. And then if you want to go beyond that, there's the ultimate VPN list. But there's nothing safer that you could do with computing. If you just did this one thing, beyond the password thing, is to use a VPN whenever you are out of your home or your work network. You're going to really go a long way to saving yourself. So that's it. That's my little bit longer security tip of the week, but hey, it's the beginning of the year.
I like that. I like resolutions. They're very nice. Yeah. So which one should we ignore? No, sorry.
That's right. Notice I didn't say anything about the, you know, losing 50 pounds. So anyway. So cool thing of the week.
Yeah.
I always love this segment because I love to see what you guys come up with. Phil.
Let's start with Tim. I started last week.
So. Oh, you did? Okay.
Oh, you did?
Okay. All right. There you go, Tim.
Well, Alcatel, who I mentioned earlier, they have a new line of phones called the Pixie that they're going to announce at CES. And they look suspiciously like iPhone 5Cs. So they come in different colors and whatnot. But what's interesting about them is they come in variety of sizes all the way down to 3.5 inches. So they go 3.5, 4, 4.5, and 5. So you can pick whatever size you want. And then the larger ones have a choice of operating systems. Wow. So you can get Android or
Windows
phone or Firefox OS of all things.
Wow.
So it's like a crazy like offering, and no word on price, but I think these will probably be fairly cheap. And I just thought it was cool. Cool idea.
Could you switch around if you wanted to?
I don't think so. I think that it's all the same hardware, so it's capable of running all of these operating systems, but you have to select it and say, okay, I just want Windows Phone as an example.
Got it.
Right. And then they ship you the thing and it's got Windows Phone on it. But it would be nice that, you know, later on, maybe Firefox OS gets actually good and you want to use it. You could maybe reflash the phone to Firefox OS.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
So I just thought it was kind of a crazy idea. And who knows, maybe now that they bought Palm, they might resurrect WebOS.
Yeah, maybe so.
Maybe.
I doubt it, though. Yeah, didn't LG buy a WebOS and they built it into their TVs? I think that's the case.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my cool thing.
All right.
Cool.
Philster.
Okay, so this was my, my connection with the Cult of Mac emails that I get. I saw this and I thought, well, this is incredibly worthless, but cool. The Ohm One levitating Bluetooth speaker.
Huh.
Okay. So it actually levitates.
It levitates above. It's like this little puck, and then it has a big ball that sort of levitates above the puck that is the speaker. So it's
amazing.
It's cool as all get out.
Is it pointless done? Is it done with the magnets in the ball or
what? I would imagine so. Yes, I haven't. I don't think it's. I don't think there's any spiritual aspect to this at all. You don't have to.
Well, I'm just wondering if it was
unless you do have to say Ohm. I don't know if you have to say Ohm to get it to go up. But if you look at the link that we put in the show notes, this Death Star has a sick sound system. So it does look like the Death Star floating there above its little stand.
Funny!
I thought it was kind of cool. It's a cool thing. It's pointless, but it's cool.
You should reverse engineer this, make an office chair out of the puck, and then sell steel underwear.
Steel undies.
So you could float above your chair. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
All right.
Only $180.
Well, still, it's kind of cool. Budget. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't. Yeah.
Well. Okay. Well, mine is, and I used to have one of these. Remember, Tim?
I do. I still have it.
You still have it. So
particular one, because it's worthless now. I guess I could put it on eBay.
Get
$5 for it.
So the product
is only works with like the second generation, iPod Touch.
Right. It's called the Blue. It's made by Blue. It's called the Mikey Digital, and it's a small condenser microphone that turns your iOS device, your iPhone or your iPad, into a mobile recording device. And I used to love this. The one thing that they couldn't do that they took out was they used to have the ability to do monitoring of the sound. Mm-hmm. You could plug headphones into it and actually hear the sound as it was being recorded. So you'd know, you know, if you were doing something incorrect or you wanted to make it directional or whatever. And so you're a little bit blind from that standpoint, but it's got a lightning connector on the bottom, and the sound quality is fabulous. I am just absolutely blown away with this little thing. And so
how much are these things?
$199.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I guess they're selling these to musicians. No, it's musicians mostly, because they show like you have a line in, you can plug in an amp or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's musicians and rich podcasters.
Well, no, but anybody that, you know, I do all kinds of remote interviewing, and so it'd be great for that. So anyway,
here's a question. No, okay. Just before we run on, I know we're running late. See the upcoming events, but here's a question for you. We're on the subject of mics, and I was talking with somebody about, you know, doing some video content for whatever, a blog or whatever. And I think the one thing that, you know, separates a very amateurish video from a video that is high quality for social media sort of aspects. Okay?
Is audio.
Absolutely. Is always the, you know, using an external mic rather than the built-in mic. Do you know, is there anybody that's building a cost-effective way of either a wireless remote mic or a significantly, at least easy wired mic, something that somebody could, you know, clip on their lapel or something like that for the iPhone or an Android device?
Well, so first off, one of my cool things of the week some time ago was a Kickstarter program where there's a real high-end product that was like $500, and I ended up taking it off because it was just too esoteric. That was that kind of a device, but you could place this box anywhere, and it would talk to wirelessly, through Bluetooth, it would talk to your iOS device, but it was a little bit too niche. To answer your question directly, if you use the USB dongle for the iOS device, you can hook in the Blue, one of the USB Blue mics. And so I, for example, have plugged my Yeti Pro into my iPad and used that for recording. Now, when you plug it in, it'll say this device is not supported, but it is. And then just record it in GarageBand on the iPad.
And it works great. You're just, how long of a lightning cable can you use?
Well, the little dongle is lightning on one end, and it's a female USB on the other. And then you can use a long USB cable. So I have an extension for mine, so I actually can stretch it about 4 feet.
4 whole feet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Still not what I'm looking for.
Well, we'll talk afterwards and you can tell me what your needs are.
I don't really need it. I was just, we were talking about it. So,
yeah. Got it.
But thank you very much, Steve.
You're welcome.
Because, you are a wealth of knowledge and insight.
You're welcome.
So, we'll share more of that knowledge and insight next week on
the Men of 8 Gang podcast. Take care.
See ya.
Nice.